Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Patient Activation Network podcast. My name is Matt Cavallo, and I'll be your host. I have with me the authors of the book Friendship Matters, Dr. Wendy Rappaport and Dr. Sanda Bernstein. Wendy and Sanda, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank
Good morning.
You.
Hello.
Good afternoon in some areas of the country.
Yeah. Right.
That's right. So before we get going, I'd like you each to take a moment just to introduce yourself to our audience and tell us a little bit about your background.
Wendy, you want to go first?
No, you're older than me. You go first.
By one day, does that count? Anyway, I think, two different orientations. One is the background of our friendship. We've been friends for almost 50 years. Through times, almost never have we lived together, and we've written this book because it's about friendship and how we've managed to do that. So I think one part of our background that's important is to recognize us in terms of our friendship. In addition, I'm a clinical psychologist, trained as a psychoanalyst and also as a school psychologist. So I've worked with all ages of people, and I've had a niche that just kind of happened in working with cancer patients who have taught me so much. And part of that I hope I can share as we're talking today.
That's great. Wendy, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm 5'9" with very long legs. I'm sorry. And actually, my doctoral dissertation was on humor as a coping mechanism in diabetes. So that's a long time ago that I've been trying to teach people how to find their humor again, especially after they're diagnosed, and also in dealing with other people. And so I've worked in diabetes, and I started out getting patients who when they were, quote unquote, the problem patients that didn't do what they should do. And then I retrained the staff to say, no, you're the problem professionals. You need to know that every patient needs a psychologist to help them adjust to the diagnosis and also to help make any changes they have to, as well as their whole families. So I think that I would call a psychologist being like the ultimate friend. And I usually know when my patients want to end or terminate their therapy with me is when they start talking about their friends, that they have now regained their closeness. So I love friendship.
You know, yeah. That is so interesting. And it's a real great starting point for this conversation because, you know, back in 2005, when I was diagnosed with MS, I started pushing people out of my life because, you know, all of a sudden I went from this, young 28-year-old man to somebody who is living with a chronic condition. And I didn't have the coping strategies to talk to my friends, family, or even my wife about it. But during that diagnosis process, nobody had addressed the fact that maybe I should see a psychologist.
I know. And you know what? This is my referral. You don't have to be crazy to see a psychologist, but you have to be crazy not to. because you're not nuts if you're, they help you in so many ways. Like you're saying, the loneliness in your adjustment, you know, how lonely for you to, you have so many difficult and hard feelings that maybe you don't want to impose on people, or maybe you don't even want to know them yourself, you know, and that's where a psychologist is so helpful. Yeah.
And what was happening to me was it was like living the same conversation over and over and over. People wanted to show sympathy or empathy and they wanted to talk to me, but it was like they forgot who I was as a person. And they focused more on that I was now this, person living with MS. How do you... What would be some strategies to maybe, you know, if I was newly diagnosed, to be able to talk to my friends and get a conversation going about how I'm still the same person, even though I'm now living with a condition?
It's such a great starting point just in saying, how do I talk to my friends about I'm the same person? Because Wendy and I were talking about this right before we spoke to you about how important it is for each person, each patient, to know what he or she needs. Like, what do I want for my friends? And to recognize that it's changing. Like, I'm working with cancer patients. I've had women say to me, like, at the beginning, I wanted one thing. I wanted them to just not pity me, leave me alone, treat me regularly. And then this same woman down the road felt like, I can't stand that I'm invisible to everybody. Nobody even asks anymore, you know, how my chemo is going. And so recognizing that it's a changing process and that you're in, like, ideally, you're in a relationship with different friends differently, and you can communicate with them about what you need and how they can help you and what they need from you in terms of cues. But there's an ongoing process and conversation, I think, that has to begin.
That was a great point, you know. And are there barriers? We put up walls when things happen to us, and that can change the relationship. Is there something from the lens of the friend that's trying to communicate with somebody that's gone through a major life change, whether it's a illness or something else? Is there some strategies that they might have to approach their dear friends and with that is going through this change?
Yeah, it's a nice point. And I think even if we could hand out a letter that was our first journal letter saying, bear with me, I plan to be, you know, moody, cold, indifferent, and angry. Oh yeah, and occasionally friendly over the next 6 months while I'm adjusting to this illness. So, I mean, that's where I think it's kind of naming it. And when we talk about that as a skill in our book, about where you name and you're predicting what your feelings are going to be. So please be patient with me. Don't drop me. Don't be angry at me. Just be with me. You know, and I think sometimes you can just learn to ask that. And if people say to you, you know, you look good. I didn't know. You say, you know what, thank you for your comments. I think you mean very well. I'm not sure why that makes me angry, but it does. And if you have it, and then say, I need you to really hear me but not be hurt by me when I tell you this. In other words, it's just really naming and talking more, or saying, you know, I can't talk now, but don't drop me. And, you know, it's funny what you were saying before. I'd like to be able to know how to get this off of YouTube, but somebody said, can you just do a two-minute thing about what should you do when you have diabetes and you're going to meet other people? And so the YouTube thing is me saying, I'm a person with diabetes. So, I mean, it looks really stupid, but the truth is that is the advice. Remember that you're a person. And you're kind of like announcing to people, I'm short-tempered now. Did I snap at you? Please bear with me. Give me a statute of limitations of 1 year before you decide to drop me, you know?
Well, and that is such a great point. One thing I just want to bring up is you just said that I'm a person living with diabetes. A lot of times when we're diagnosed with something, we give up being a person and we become a patient. You know, we get labeled as a diabetic patient or an MS patient. And, you know, I think it is so powerful what you just said as a way to change that conversation, because I am a person and you know, our relationship may evolve and I may have some troubles, but that is just such a great point. Speaking of relationships evolving, you guys said that you've been friends for 50 years, and, you know, there's been a difference in, you know, places. You've rarely lived together. Is there strategies for, you know, as you've grown as people over those 50 years, are there strategies for saying, you know, that you weren't a moment in time, you weren't that person that you were when you first met each other, but you still have some common ground? How do you grow a relationship over time?
Oh, Sandy. Yeah, I'm thinking, I think our book really, we wrote the book in part because we looked back, it's been about 5 years in the making. We looked back and we said, how did we do this? Why did we do this? What were we looking for? And I think we really Yes, life changed, life events changed, distance, geography changed, but ultimately, like, we were committed to each other and growing from and with each other. And I think we learned strategies along the way about how to communicate effectively, how to teach one another better strategies. My son read the draft of our book, and he said, "Mom, you know, you talk about your friendship as, among other things, besides it being fun and good, a laboratory in which you like learned about relationships with one another." And I thought, we both thought, I think, wow, that's right. That's part of what we did. We really, like in a marriage, you know, you don't just go along. You put energy into making it work. And I think we decided that our relationship was worth it. So we put energy in.
And regularity. That was the other thing, too.
And regularity.
We've spoken every single morning for like at least 30 years out of the 50. On a Tuesday from 9 to 9:30, so don't call either of us at that time because we don't have to talk. Though I know Sandy sometimes wants to get off and do it, but...
speak for yourself, honey.
So we talk, and you know, a lot of times I don't even know the details of her life, but I know the details of her feelings about her life, you know, because that's the way that we have done it. Like, you know, we just understand and are interested in knowing how that thing affects us. So we're very much, you know, feeling friends as well as factual friends.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think struck both of us in reading about you and about the Patient Activation Network and how much I think we both believe in the importance of empowering yourself to be the best patient you could be. And I think I felt like the corollary to that is to empower yourself to have a great friend along the way with you, because you don't want to do it alone. You can do it alone, but friends are good for your health. They're good for your mental health. They're good for your physical health. They make stress less, so don't go it alone. Like, that's what I wanted to put in it. It's great to be activated and to be empowered, and that's essential. But in addition, it's really essential to have a friend, somebody who gets you and is going to be a support and buoy you up, and you're going to teach what you need, and he or she's going to teach what he or she needs.
So I'm sitting here today, and I'm listening to you guys talk, and I'm thinking about the people that were in my life 20 years ago that I need today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or the ones 12 years ago when I was diagnosed with MS that I left behind. Is there any way, you know, like, to now I'm in a completely different space and time and place in my life. Is there any way to reach back out to them, even though I shut the door so long ago?
Oh, I know what we both would say. I know. We would both, no question, say, why would you not try?
Well, and, you know, the gift would be to them, and this is how I would see the letter or the phone call would be, here's what I remember about you. You were fun. You were easy to talk to. You know, where you go back and you remind them and yourself of what was great about the relationship. And then talk about your loss, because here's the thing. You had a loss, but now you have mastery. You have altruism. You give back to others. So this, in a way, is giving back to the friend that you lost in a certain way. And it doesn't really matter what the outcome is. It's more just saying, this is what I remember about you. It was a painful time for me, but I think about how much I've overcome and who I became, you know, like a better man from what I had to go through. No, thank you, but okay, so I had no choice, but I did become a better man, and I was thinking about you and missing you. I think anybody would probably be really responsive, but you have to guard yourself against that. They may be people who felt, you know, that it was difficult for them, or they've been mad all these years, they can't let it go, that they felt you dropped them. So you have to just say it in a generous way with very low expectations back. But I think it's healing. I mean, it sounds like you have sadness yourself, as people might, you know, but look how open you are to yourself about missing those friends, or realizing how far you come and how hard it was for you. I think it's a gift for you, and I think it's a gift for them.
It's just always been, you know, it's something that as I've gone around and I've spoke to different patient groups, it's a continuing theme because, you know, your diagnosis of an illness is almost the rebirth of a new and different person, and that person doesn't always know how to communicate with what they're going through with the people around them. And some of the things you were bringing up earlier, like the frustration, and I might be moody or maybe, you know, something I have to, some treatment is making me feel a certain way. You know, a lot of times we self-select out of a group because, you know, we don't want to be remembered as somebody that's, you know, going through these struggles. And, you know, I as I look back at my friends and, you know, all the good times we've had, that's what I want them to remember. I don't want them to think of me as this other person. And, you know, thank you for giving me that I love what you said about, you know, this is what I remember about us. I think that is so powerful.
Oh, good. And you know what? And it's true in families, too. Like, you don't drop your families, but, you know, maybe you're rude to your wife or rude to your mother for the first year. And I sort of say to people, you know, we're having amnesty here. You know, like, you know, this wasn't about you. You know, your son's anger who got diabetes is not about you. Your son's anger was that he had the freedom to be angry around you and that you didn't get angry back. Maybe you got too depressed, but... And that's the reason, by the way, why I like the idea, and Sandy and I both agree on this, that a psychologist should be the first person you see when you're diagnosed. You know, and I do a lot of training for professionals, nurses and doctors, saying, because they also don't know what to say, or maybe they can't ask you, or you don't feel good. They feel like they did something wrong, like, oh, why'd you have that turn for the worse? Or in diabetes, where there's a lot of management that's about you, not so much the course of the illness. You know, a patient comes in and gains 15 pounds. The doctor feels bad, so he's angry, or he's depressed, you know, she or she. So, you know, it's like a systems approach, you know, like when you're diagnosed, you live in a system. You live in the system of your medical team, you live in the system of your family, and the system of your friends. We should all be on board. That's where I think Sandy and I agree on, that a psychologist should be at the beginning to talk about that this is true. How can you have this illness and not have someone hold your hand while you're having a fit? You know, and that person says, oh, thank you for trusting me. You know, what a gift. Because people, you know, everybody's self-centered in some ways. So if you drop a friend, they think, well, I guess they didn't think I was a nice enough friend. You know, who knows what they were thinking, right? But I always assume that they were thinking something that they felt bad about themselves, not you.
Yeah, and you know, I wish, looking back 12 years ago when I was diagnosed, I wish I had had somebody hold my hand and help me cross that bridge so I could have been a better friend, so I could have helped educate my friends and open myself up instead of close myself off. Speaking of closing yourself off, you know, we have different relationships in our lives, and even some of our professional relationships are somewhat friend-like. You know, if you go through this kind of a life change, whether you're diagnosed with an illness or something like that, you know, do you have any strategies for talking to your employer about it, or recognizing whether people at work are your friends or they're just coworkers? Has this been something you've explored?
I do. I think, you know, and part of this is like a skill set in the book that we talk about. It's not just between friends, but it would be between you and your employer, or you and your doctor, you know, where you give people credit. Thank you for being interested. Or can I interest you in a little bit about what's going on for me? Or would that be a burden? Asking a question, you know, maybe, but never assuming that it's something negative to the other person. Most people want to be included in things. You know, so my strategy is naming it. I mean, like Sandy and I talk about in the book, we talk about, you know, emotional regulation, you know, which is part of emotional literacy, realizing that you feel annoyed and calming yourself down before you speak, and then being able to put the positive in. You know, we have been great coworkers. You know, has my illness affected you in some way that you feel like you could share? I'm ready to hear it now. I wasn't ready to hear it 6 months ago. you know, or what was it like for you? Just being interested in the other. That's a skill set. You know, employers are still people.
Well, and so it's okay to ask. You know, it's okay to tell them that you need a special accommodation. And this book has those kind of strategies for people like me that might have a difficulty asking those questions. And I want to talk a little bit more about the book. The book is Friendship Matters, Memoir, Life Lessons, and Laughter. You know, as a fellow author, writing a book is no small task. And I know with clinical practice, you guys are seeing patients all the time. How did you carve out the time to write a memoir together?
Well, it took many years of putting it between us. We almost never were in the same place when we were writing. So we would schedule times when we sat at our computer, use Google Docs, and created a conversation on paper between Wendy and me. And so I think there was some pleasure, a great pleasure, really. It was a deepening of our friendship to do it. I think it would have been, for me, lonelier to do it by myself. But to do it with her, we kind of riffed off each other and expanded our points of view based on talking and clarified our thinking based on writing back and forth. So it was a growing experience, but it did take a long time.
Yes, and we learned about our differences because we were naming them, you know, and it was a little bit of a shock, I think, to both of us. You know, we have very different styles, which we've always, you know, our differences have helped us because I'm always the first one to say, well, do this, do that, go do this. And Sandy would say, why don't you say a little more about how that feels for you or why you need to do that? You know, she slows me down and makes me deep, you know, and...
And Wendy is creative and quick and clever and persistent. And she doesn't take no for an answer. And she helps the people in her life not take no for an answer, not be afraid to go get it, go for it, speak to that person. Don't be afraid. What's the worst that could happen?
So what is that one thing that you learned about each other that was most important to you in this process?
You know, I really realized first of all, writing itself, and there is a lot of research that says, like, when people get diagnosed with any illness, if they write about it, what it means to them, what they feel about it, they will do better. So I think writing is just another way of talking through, say, with the psychologist. So I feel like that's always something you should do. But I have learned to, not so much, so, but I have learned a little to slow down, and Sandy and I joke about that, like I should look down and make sure there's water in the pool before I jump. So far I haven't broken my neck, which is a really good thing. So
right. I'd hate for you to give that up. Just like that's what it is, like learning that balance between admiring the parts of the other that we want to take in but still retaining ourselves. I think that learning how to do that has been one of what the major growth areas that's come out of the book for me.
Wow. Now, you guys both use a lot of humor. Do we have humor as coping strategies in this book?
Oh, yes. The book is,
you know what?
The book is a conversation between Wendy and me, so you can imagine what it sounds like. I mean, there's Wendy, and then she's writing something, and I'm saying, wait, I need a rejoinder to that.
But you know something interesting, Matt? We talk in the book about emotional literacy, which is knowing yourself and having empathy for other people, you know, as a basic way to start. And then your friendship is that you have this incredibly good mother who has your back. But then we went A through G, and I thought, Sandy, if we do another version, we should need to do A through H, because the H is the humor. It's such,
right.
You know, because when you have illness, you have to talk to so many more people so much more often than you might want to. So if you do everything with a little bit of humor, it's not painful. You know, people say to you, oh, you know, tell me why, like in diabetes, for example, you know, can you eat that? I teach people how, that's so annoying. Like, mind your own business. I teach them how to know that they feel that and to use empathy, that the person is really wanting to be helpful. So if you can tone yourself down and maybe go with a little humor, for example, when kids, if somebody says, is it contagious? So I teach young kids to say, thanks for asking. It's contagious if I don't like you. Then I tell them to not really say that, but to think that, because that using that humor makes you realize you're really okay and you're powerful, not over them, but over yourself.
And that's where some of the sensitivity that I've experienced through my own, acceptance of my disease process has come through humor. I've learned to drop my guard a little bit and be a little bit more open than I was initially, and I really think that humor helped aid me get to that next point, of acceptance.
Yes, and for them too, not just for you as well, but it facilitates other people to connect to you. Yes.
I love that you said that humor gives you power over the situation. That was so powerful to me. And, a lot of what we've talked about has been just such great advice that everyone can use in their day-to-day relationships, whether you've got a chronic illness or not.
Absolutely. That part's so important to underline. None of this is unique for chronic illness. It's about humans dealing with other human beings and managing emotions that could come from all different kinds of obstacles.
Yes, and with chronic illness, it just adds more so, because there's always somebody who's going to say something to you about it. Did you take your pills? Are you going to the doctor again? Yes, he pays me to show up. I can't help it. Just being able to answer all those questions, all those comments, and to step back, to emotionally regulate, to go from being pissed off at what they've just said, adding a little empathy that they mean well, they mean interest, and then if you can go for the humor, great. If not, you at least stay with your own dignity and strength.
The book Friendship Matters is available on Amazon.com, and you can learn more about the book at friendshipmatters.com. Are there any closing thoughts, anything that you want to leave our audience with?
One thing about the friendship is that, of course, you feel better when you're with a friend, but you actually do better when you have friends. And if you didn't have a chronic illness, there's some research that shows, if you were fat, didn't exercise, and ate fried foods, but you had a lot of friends, you'd live longer than someone who was fat, exercised, and had no friends. So that's the most politically incorrect conversation I just had. But you actually do better with friends. You feel better, but you do better. And especially say with an illness like diabetes, where you have to change so much of your behavior, if your friends are eating healthy, that's so much easier for you, what I've seen happen in when kids get diagnosed with diabetes, the family really changes how they eat. And all of a sudden the mother who was overweight before has now lost weight, and everybody in the family is exercising. So in a strange way, the diabetes brought, closeness and better habits. So we do better, we feel better. Sandy, you got a thought?
And with any chronic illness or any difficulty, don't go it alone. Have a friend with you.
That was a perfect quote to end on. I want to thank Dr. Wendy Rappaport and Dr. Sandra Bernstein for joining the podcast today. Thank you both for coming here.
Our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And for doing this, Matt. It's a wonderful service to other people.
And what you do is a wonderful service to people like me that maybe need some help getting back out there into the world. So we couldn't thank you enough. If you want to learn more about the book Friendship Matters, please visit friendshipmattersbook.com. Thank you all for tuning in, and thank you for for listening to our podcast. This has been the Patient Activation Network, and we look forward to bringing you another inspirational story soon.